You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Happy Friday and welcome to the podcast that is always up to speed with Formula One. Joining you as always is Mr. Mark Daly and also Mr. Mark Hamilton. Both of us nestled here in the coastal mountains on the west coast of Canada, excited and ready for one of the most prestigious, and we'll get into this, but one of the most prestigious events on the Formula One calendar. And we've had a ton of questions this week asking about what makes Monaco so special, why is it so treasured on the calendar, what is the racing like, and we'll get to all of that. But my friend, I know you've had a busy week. How are you? You look great.
No, I'm awesome. You know why? Because this is my first day off in a run of 4 days. So for those of you who don't know, it's Victoria Day long weekend. Isn't it Memorial Day down in the States this weekend too? So, I mean, it's holiday kind of time of year. Anyways, I took Friday off, Saturday, Monday's the holiday, of course. So I'm looking forward to 4 days. Of course, Tuesday's going to come pretty quick, but I'm just going to ignore that. We got Formula One on top of that. You know, I've been out cycling all the time. You know, the weather's been nice and the news has been pretty good around here lately. So it's checking a lot of boxes. So I'm one happy camper, even though I'm not going camping.
We talked about this last week, but it kind of feels like up here in Canada, or at least in British Columbia, as far as the vaccines are concerned, it's kind of like somebody just turned on the tap and it's everywhere. Everyone's getting them. They're accessible to everybody. I think young people as young as 12, I think now, are able to book appointments. So it feels like there's some really positive momentum. And like you said, the weather's good. So we've got so much to look forward to. And we live in a province of 5 million people, or just a shade over 5 million people. And I think we're down to about 300 or 400 cases a day, which is super, super exciting. But yeah, lots going on, especially in the world of Formula One. This event is really, really unique because we typically record these podcasts on a Thursday night, drop them at some point during Friday, get people primed for the weekend, get people primed for Free Practice 1 and Free Practice 2. But one of the things that's really unique about Monaco is Free Practice 1 and Free Practice 2 are already in the books.
I know that's actually kind of cool too as well, because it actually gives us something new to talk about. But I don't even want to talk about what happened on the track just yet. I wanted to talk about what happened off the track, because I must admit I had some extremely impure thoughts when I saw the new McLaren livery that's going into this weekend. Oh my God, does that car look amazing. The retro throwback with that, with the papaya, the Gulf light blue colors on there, the retro helmets that Danny Ricciardo and Lando Norris are going to have. I must admit that it completely blew my mind. And when I heard last year, what was it last year? I think it was sometime early 2020 when they announced Gulf as a sponsor again. This was something that I was hoping that they were going to do. I mean, I think that they've really hit a home run with the papaya, that, you know, the McLaren historical colors anyways, but this car looks absolutely amazing. It gets a 12 out of 10 for me.
I completely agree. And McLaren had begun inadvertently or indirectly teasing that something was going to come on Sunday last week. So it looks like they'd had a press event at the MTC, the McLaren Technology Center in the UK, and they'd invited some members of the media, and they had them all under NDA. But what these folks were saying was they were tweeting and they're reporting that, hey, something exciting, McLaren's going to announce something exciting on Sunday. And it's like, what would they be announcing on a Sunday? Like, the driver lineup seems pretty good. They've got a new engine supplier. Like, what could it be? And then people started suggesting maybe it's a new sponsor, maybe it's a new livery. And that kind of made sense, because Monaco is a very special event on the calendar, and it's not unusual for drivers to bring out a special helmet or teams to flex in special ways when it comes to livery and things like that. Mm-hmm. So they've unveiled this unbelievable, super sexy livery. It's a one-time thing, and we talked about this a little bit on Twitter, and if you don't follow us on Twitter, please, please, please do. And for all those folks that joined us over the last week, thank you. We try to keep it fun. We try to keep it interactive. But that was one of the questions that came up last week, was can they keep this indefinitely?
I wish they could.
Yeah, so do I. It looks amazing. And I think I must have used that Fry from Futurama meme 100 times, which is take my money when it comes to merch and things like that. But you're totally right.
Absolutely.
It looks fantastic. And it wasn't even the only big news story for McLaren this week, which is the crazy thing. And we'll get to this a little bit later, but they re-signed one of their drivers, and we'll get to that later, to a multi-year deal, whatever that means. So an exciting week for McLaren fans for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. So do you want to dive into the news from free practice over the last day? Because I've got an email here that I think we should talk about, because the one thing that we talked about last week about the bendy wings, the inflexibility or
we
the flexibility.
We did for about 28 minutes.
Yeah, I know. I couldn't remember if it was last week or the week before. Anyways, this has become a thing, and it's become, you know, something that a lot of the different teams have been weighing in on, that they're not too happy about it. But maybe this has something to do, it's going to kind of lead into a big conversation here. Anyways, first emails from Colin Johnson, emailing in from Yarmouth, Nova Scotia, which is awesome. Anyways, Colin has to say, I'm not a Drive to Survivor. I've been watching F1 for about 10 years and have more than a basic understanding of the sport. I'm sitting at home watching the recorded P2 session. I'm having a hard time believing how fast Ferrari are. How is it possible after the debacle that was last year? How does a team that struggled so badly not even a year ago heads to P1 and P2 in practice? BS. Apologies to you both for the expletive, but how can that happen? And is the FIA being truthful about Ferrari in general? Can you explain how they go from basically being the laughingstock of Formula One's most established franchises to the top of the charts in any session? This makes no sense to me. The recovery that they have miraculously made is virtually impossible. Please break this down for me. So we've kind of touched on it a little bit, but one of the things I find amazing is that Ferrari admitted that this week that they are one of the teams that have, you know, they openly said this, that they are one of the teams that have been experimenting with these bendy, flexible rear wings. Now, this is astonishing on a couple of levels, because there was this video that was floating around about a week ago where somebody took some of the in-car footage from behind Max Verstappen. You could see how the wing would flex. Like, basically, he drew a line across the top and you could see how it would drop, you know, when there was a certain load on that that rear wing, which basically makes it, you know, reduces the downforce and basically acts like a pseudo DRS system, right? Which increases
totally.
the straight line speed, right? So we know that Red Bull is doing it. Ferrari's admitted that they've experimented with it. And I was blown away by this admission, because after this, what we suspect to be an illegal fuel map that they were running a couple of years ago, which led to that, investigation and that secret agreement that they had with the FIA, and last year's ridiculous laughing stock of a season, as Colin put it, you know, to being a team that is vastly improved. And then, of course, you have to take practice times with a bit of a pinch of salt, and maybe Monaco a little bit more so, because it can be a bit of a lottery, this race. But I have to admit, when I see these times myself, I have to be a little bit, I look at them somewhat incredulously and also somewhat skeptically. I think is probably the better word. I mean, and the other thing is, just to sort of round out this multi-octopus of a kind of train of thoughts here, but doesn't it not blow you away that they've admitted to experimenting with these flexible rear wings? Don't you think that they would have, put their hand in the fire so recently that they would have maybe thought twice about maybe skirting around the rules a little bit? I mean, they haven't been banned. There hasn't been a technical directive about it. But I mean, it's really, really shady, this flexible rear wing thing. And if I think I was Ferrari, I would probably, you would think you would be erring on the side of caution when it comes to this kind of thing.
It's really funny, because especially when it comes to flex in aerodynamics, this is something that's not new. Like, this concept of a bendy, flexy rear wing that's helping them avoid drag and downforce to get faster straight line speed, this isn't unusual. This isn't new. This is something that the sport's been battling for the last 20 years, or really ever since aerodynamics became a really significant part of the sport. It's unusual in that we're seeing it in the rear wing. Typically, what we see is teams get really bendy and flexy on the front wing. This is just the first time that we've seen it on the back wing. And all teams are going to push their luck as far as they can. I think what was surprising about what we saw last race with Red Bull was just how obvious it became. there again, these wings are designed to have some elasticity because if they don't, under load, they'll shatter, and that's not good for anyone. So there's got to be a little bit, but ultimately, I think Red Bull just pushed their luck. It is kind of funny to your point that Ferrari, of all teams, would offer that up in a public statement, like, yeah, we're pushing our luck here too. Bendy wings are a great thing. And I also think that the timing here is perfect because we got a tweet, or let me take a look here. Let me just bring up my notes. We got a great tweet from Wallace Torres, who asked very much the same question that you were just speaking to. And he says, F1 newbie here, how meaningful are the practice results? Both Ferraris on top today. Does it mean anything for qualifying? And I think my sentiment is very much like yours, that to me, practice doesn't mean a whole lot. And especially at Monaco, when you consider as well that we have four or five drivers, and if I look at the list here, it's the first time Latifi's ever seen this track. It's the first time Yuki's seen it, the first time Mazepan's seen it, the first time that Mick Schumacher seen it. So for 25% of your drivers, this isn't even a track they've ever seen, which means they're going to be super cautious. They're going to be very, very conservative. They don't want to kiss a wall. And likewise, I think if I'm Mercedes, you know what? I'm confident that my drivers know this track. I'm confident that we know what setup we need to achieve. I'm not going to go out there and burn through tires unnecessarily. So for some of these top teams, it's not really advantageous for them to push too hard in free practice, especially on a track like this, because the margin for error is so low that if you make a mistake, you know what, if you're in Monza or Silverstone or some of these other tracks with a lot of runoff, well, probably less so Monza, but Silverstone, which has a tremendous amount of runoff, you can push in practice because if you make a mistake, you spin on the grass. If you push in practice in Monaco, you kiss a wall and that entire free practice session might get red flagged. And then your mechanics are busy trying to rebuild your car and you're shaking up. So for these top teams, there's no true advantage for pushing for a top time. The other thing we should probably remember too, at least in free practice too, is the session got red flagged because Mick kissed a wall and nobody had the opportunity to top the times that Sainz and Sainz and Leclerc put in. So again, I think to answer the question, I don't put a ton of stock in free practice, especially on a track like this.
Yeah, great point. And I just want to just rewind it. I had in my notes here as well, going back to the flexible rear wings. So the FIA has informed the teams that come the French Grand Prix that they are going to introduce some new wing tests to stop them exploiting these flexible aerodynamics, pardon me. And so they've got a couple of races to get it sorted out. Now, it led to a couple of, interesting comments. Andrea Seidel, team principal of McLaren, he's not too happy about it. He feels that having that extra couple of races at Monaco and Baku is going to give the teams that are exploiting these rules to, he feels they've basically had an unfair advantage and it's basically giving them time to cover their tracks. Toto Wolff, team principal at Mercedes, he had to say, quote, delaying the introduction for whatever reason leaves us in a legal vacuum and leaves the door open for protest. It's not only us, but it's probably two other teams that are most affected, maybe more, and obviously a protest could end up in the ICA, which is the International Court of Appeal. This is a messy situation. It can take weeks before we have a result, and we should not have ended in this situation if we're having 4 weeks until the race that is most relevant in the calendar, end quote. So, you know, it is interesting. I mean, protests are nothing new in Formula One. We saw this last year in Formula One with the whole thing about the pink Mercedes and the rolling protests, basically, from McLaren and from Renault and others after each and every race until they finally busted them on the brake ducts that were basically off the 2019 Mercedes. So, anyways, no reason to sort of rehash, but it's funny, something that wasn't even really on our radar a week or two ago has really become a really messy and nasty situation, which could end up with there being some provisional results, right? I mean, if a result is protested and it kind of goes through the process, it could flip the standings on its head, because if it's kind of found out afterwards and penalties are involved, then who knows, people might have points deducted. And I guess it's Formula One at its not its finest, but it is something we've seen before. Let's put it that way.
Totally. And I just want to clarify as well that what the FIA and what Formula One are going to start doing isn't new. It's not like they haven't been testing for deformation in the wings. It's just whatever tests they've been applying, whatever low tests they've been applying, haven't been effective enough to pick up on how – how bendy these wings have become. And as it turns out, there is actually allowances in the Formula One technical regulations that allow the FIA to go back and revisit the way that they do stress tests and load tests on wings. So that's effectively what's being incorporated here, which is the FIA throwing their hands up saying, hey, whatever we're doing now isn't catching what they're able to do from an engineering perspective. We need to revisit that, and we're going to come back with a much more comprehensive test to help identify whether teams are really pushing the boundaries too much.
Yeah, it's just it's one of these weird things, you know, in Formula One. I mean, the sport goes so fast. And yeah, I know, right? Anyways, one thing I wanted to talk about, too, just sticking with Ferrari, Carlos Sainz, that is, one of the drivers, he says that he believes that Ferrari are very close to being a genuine threat in Monaco. So, again, here we go with going back to that topic again. Anyways, Carlos had to say, quote, we definitely look very close to being a genuine threat. I think we need to wait until FP3 because things can change a lot from Thursday to Saturday here. There are some drivers that stand a bit back on Thursday just because they want to take it easy. And then suddenly on Saturday, like Lewis always does, he's super quick, end quote. So there you go. I mean, Carlos, I think, you know, very nicely summed up to what you were just talking about is that sometimes, you know, the guys just aren't pushing it because, you know, like you're saying, I mean, if you kiss the wall, then, you know, you're damaging your car. That's going to be a lot of work that the mechanics are going to have to do to rebuild that car, because it's not like, you know, you've gone off into the gravel and they're just pulling rocks out of your radiators and out of the side pods. You know, it's going to be a major rebuild. But it is interesting that this Ferrari situation is going to be one that is going to come with a lot of scrutiny. And, you know, it goes back to the email that we just read out, that if all of a sudden they suddenly appear to be so good again, then people are naturally going to be suspicious about that. I just think based on their recent history, it's just it's a logical conclusion, don't you think?
I've never thought about it that way, but I think you're absolutely right that they don't necessarily get the benefit of the doubt at this point, simply because the last time they looked hyper-competitive, it came to a screeching halt very quickly. And I think we can all draw conclusions as to why that's the case. And I think that's why, to your earlier point as well, why it's so suspicious that they would offer up this information in a public setting. And maybe part of it is just media relations, in the sense that, hey, the FIA is going to pick up on this anyways. We should probably get in front of it and just concede that, hey, we're doing this. Everyone's doing this. So it's not so react. You don't have to be in such a reactive position when the FIA announces that, hey, your wing's as bendy as that which we've seen with Red Bull, because ultimately people haven't been looking. People have been scrutinizing and looking very closely at Red Bulls. They haven't been looking as closely as at Ferrari. I think maybe the one thing that, and this is probably useful for the listeners to know, and we talked about this the last couple of weeks, in that Monaco it's a very different track. It's a much more unpredictable track, simply because qualifying plays such an important role. There's such a high risk of damage, of safety cars, and all those other kind of pieces. But I think one of the most, I don't want to call it memorable features, but one of the most prevalent features of this track is there aren't a lot of really long straightaways. So cars with high top speeds or cars that have a remarkable amount of acceleration don't necessarily have the same advantage here that they would at other tracks. So that bendy wing presumably isn't going to be as effective a tool. And if it is on the back of the car, it's not going to be as obvious because the wings aren't going to see the same kind of load that they would see on a straightaway to a traditional circuit.
Yeah, absolutely. Hey, let's take a quick break here, Mark. And when we come back, I want to talk about Lewis Hamilton and Max Verstappen and some of the things that have been going around and discussions about their title battle. And we'll do that in just a moment, so don't go away. We'll be right back. Passion, drive, and patience. The formula for winning championships is also what keeps your ride or die alive. eBay Motors has everything you need to maintain your vehicle and level it up to peak performance. Superchargers, roof racks, exhaust kits, LED headlights, and more. Whether you're into speed, power, or style, eBay Motors has you covered. With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you'll always find exactly what you're looking for. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, your part is guaranteed to fit your ride every time or your money back. Because with eBay Motors, you're burning rubber, not cash. With all the parts you need at the prices you want, it's easy to make your car the MVP and bring home huge wins. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
All right. Well, welcome back to the show. And well, yeah, I wanted to talk a little bit now about Max and Lewis. And Lewis himself had to say that he feels that he's done well to avoid any incidents or crashes with rival Max Verstappen so far. And he thinks at this moment, at any rate, that there's what he calls a balanced respect between the two of them. And I think certainly from Lewis's point of view, it was very much on display in Spain a couple of weeks ago, even though he went on to win that race just in that first corner on the opening lap where they both went in. Max had the inside line, Lewis maybe a little bit further ahead, maybe just maybe by a tire width or two, but he did back off, gave Max the space that he needed. Anyways, he won the race in the long run, but it's interesting. When I see that, I have to wonder if that is going to be reciprocated by Max. I think so. If you kind of look at that, go back maybe to Bahrain in the opening race of the year when Max, you know, he went to exceeded the track limits. And even though he said afterwards he didn't really feel like he wanted to give the position back, he did. So I think that there is, but I think that if there is any more respect, I think maybe it's going to come more from Lewis. It might be a sort of a 60-40 thing or a 70-30, but I think Lewis is going to be the more sporting of the two, at least at this point.
I completely agree. I think the dynamic, though, for Max Verstappen has changed this year. If you look at the last 3 or 4 years, or really the entirety of his time with Red Bull, they've never really been in a meaningful battle for either driver's title. So when Max has been on the track, his only concern is racing his own race to accumulate his own driver's championship points, right? That's what he's looking to do. I think that the pressures on him are different this year because ultimately he's working to accumulate points both for his own driver's championship, but also for the team's constructor's championship. And I think their race strategy and I think his personal racing philosophy this year have to be a little bit different. And I think getting very, very aggressive and getting tangled up and potentially compromising all of the points in a race rather than simply a position isn't probably something that Christian Horner and the Red Bull team are going to accept this year. And I think his approach is going to be different, especially for probably the first 2/3 of the calendar, especially if it's close. I think he's going to be fast, and I think he's going to be aggressive, but I don't think he's going to initiate contact in ways that we may have seen in the past, simply because I think there's pressures on him and there's opportunities for him to win this year, and he doesn't want to compromise any points because the championship could be close. And if you tangle with a driver and you damage your suspension and you DNF, you might leave 15 or 20 points on the table, and you cannot afford to lose any of those points. And likewise, like I said, I think part of it's because he's really helping the team chase 2 titles this year, which is not a position he's been in, and I think that's probably changed the way that he approaches the races. And I think the team has probably been very clear with him as well that ultimately we want you to be aggressive, we want you to be the alpha, we want you to fight for the race wins, but you cannot afford to throw them away. This is the best package we've ever given you in terms of the car and the power unit. You know what, last year we had some bad luck, there were a flurry of DNFs, but we were never in title contention anyways. This year we're in title contention. Do not throw it away over an unnecessarily aggressive move, and do not initiate contact. And I think the message ultimately is, look, if Hamilton is better pace, I'm not saying let him through, but don't make stupid mistakes that could compromise 20 points for us in the championship.
Yeah, exactly. And just to add a bit of a twist to this conversation, Lewis had to say also this week that in addition to the fact that they've avoided having an accident or any incidents this year, he said that he feels that perhaps Max has a lot to prove. So anyways, Max, he had to say, quote, nope, I have nothing to prove. And avoiding contact, I think that goes both ways. So we have done well, that's true. But yeah, we race hard. We avoided contact both sides. So let's hope we can keep doing that on the being on the track and racing hard against each other. okay, I see, you know, that he recognizes that, but when he says, nope, nothing to prove, okay, you're talking about being in a title battle with a 7-time world champion, and you feel like you don't have anything to prove? I'm going to call you out on that. I'm sorry, Max. I mean, the thing is, if you want to be the best, you got to beat the best, and Lewis is the best, bar none. He's been the best for all these years, so to say that, you know, he's got nothing to prove, I think that's... I think he would probably want to reevaluate that comment. I think there's an element of psychological warfare in there from Max, not letting the pressure get to him, but I don't see how he could really say that in public, honestly.
I just want to back up that comment too, because I think we're giving these two guys who make a combined $60 million US, we're giving them an awful lot of credit for not crashing into each other through four races in the calendar. Like, kudos to the two best drivers. Formula One,
yeah,
for not initiating contact. Like, we're probably giving them too much credit this early in the championship, but I think you're absolutely right that Max is a great driver. He's got a great package. I think if I was building a Formula One team, I think I would probably want to build around a driver like Max Verstappen, but he's never been in a championship battle, and we don't necessarily know how he's going to withstand the psychological warfare that we know is going to come from Lewis Hamilton, because he's been both the recipient and the offensive in terms of those past experiences. Like, we've never seen him 5 races out from a championship. We've never seen him 3 races out. We don't know how he's necessarily going to handle. And I have every confidence he's going to be fine. But ultimately, he's never been that close to a championship. Lewis has, to your point, won 7 of them. Like, Lewis is the one that has nothing to prove. Max, you have everything in the world to prove. Mm-hmm. You've proven you can win a Grand Prix with a great car. You've proven that you can put in some great lap times. You've proven you can race in the wet. You've never proven that you can win a championship. If you win a championship this year, then those comments can apply next year. They don't apply now.
Yeah. And just to sort of take this a little bit further than that, because, you know, well, actually, before I do that, I do want to say that what we've seen in Bahrain, in Imola, in Portugal, in Spain so far, I mean, it's been great. The last thing I want to see is an incident between these two that I guess maybe makes them dial it back a little bit and maybe give each other way more space. I like seeing good, hard, fair racing. I'd like to see that continue. But anyways, what I wanted to talk about now is, I think we talked about it last week. We had an email that addressed the ham goats issue. And I said, you know, I was basically done with that whole discussion about Hamilton being the greatest of all time. But Danny Ricciardo had to kind of wade into this conversation this week. And anyways, he said that he believes that that Lewis is what he's calling hard fought victories this year in Formula One are starting to help silence the doubters who have questioned how good Lewis is. And he's only won just because he's had, you know, the best car for all these years. And I think that really is a good point, because I mean, the other week, I mean, last week in Spain and then in Portugal, it was maybe not quite as hard as it was maybe the first couple of wins he had of the season. Of course, Max won in between as well. But the thing is, Lewis is not like 40, 50, 60 seconds down the road. And, you know, he hasn't been challenged since lap 5 or something like that. I mean, he's actually had to work kind of hard for them. So I think it's interesting to see or hear a comment like that from one of his peers, one of his fellow drivers. I mean, what Danny Ricca was saying was exactly this, quote, a lot of people are probably tipping their hat to Lewis. He's getting it dished back at him and he's holding his ground. And I guess showing people that maybe doubted him why he is good as he is. At this stage, you'd always guess take experience. So if it's really down to the wire, then I think Lewis has showed some very strong signs. But then again, if there's a gap, Max, go for it. That's why, obviously, I respect Max a lot, end quote. Anyways, it's kind of a little bit all over the place, but I think it is true. I mean, that he's recognizing the fact that Lewis hasn't had it easy to him, and he's had to work pretty good. I mean, his team's helped him out with some pretty good tactics and strategies as well. And, you know, it's kind of been a full team effort, right?
I don't think anything Lewis can do through the balance of his career will silence the critics. I think I think the most vocal of Lewis's critics, and those are the ones that are typically in the British tabloids that kind of rile up the social media crowd that are kind of on the fence already, I don't think anything will silence them, which is really, really unfortunate. And I think the sense I get is that our audience is very, very balanced, and I think they're very objective, and I think they're willing to listen to opinions, and I think they're willing to credit drivers with great drives. Mm-hmm. But I think there's just a certain segment of the media and the press that will never credit Lewis for anything. So it doesn't matter what this championships look like. And, you know, maybe it comes down to the wire and Lewis wins by a point. I don't think he'll get credit, and I think people will just defer to the fact that he has the best car, and he has the best engine, he has the best team, and they spend the most money, and he's the highest paid driver, and he should win. Like, there's always... It's too easy to criticize Lewis, and I just don't think he's ever going to get credit from this point on, short of taking a seat at Haas and pulling them to the top three in the Constructors' Championship. I just think he's in a really tough position.
Yeah, I think so too. Anyways, no more ham goat discussion in this episode. Where was the next one? Where did I want to go with this? We could go to the one I sort of mentioned a little bit earlier. Do we really want to talk about Hamilton and talking about how surprised he was at Ferrari being so strong in Monaco in practice? Maybe, maybe not. I guess it's just more of the same. But I guess it kind of goes back, you know, without diving into this one again, since we already talked about it. But I think it's one of those funny things that, you know, just based on their recent history, whenever they have something, whether it's legit or not, everybody's, you know, automatically raising eyebrows and being suspicious about it. And even Lewis is the same position that, oh, Ferrari's quick. Well, I'm a bit surprised about that. You know, what's going on there? So I think that's kind of funny, actually.
Oh, goodness. Got nothing to add to that.
Yeah. But, you know, the one thing I did find a little bit interesting to go back and just to sort of revisit this one a little bit is that Max was saying that he thinks that Red Bull is very weak compared to Ferrari. Now, I think that would be really quite disturbing considering how good Red Bull has been over the first three, four races of the year. I mean, maybe that car wasn't really adapted to two very similar circuits at Barcelona and Portimao. But, I mean, they were pretty good over the first two races. So what Max had to say was, quote, "We are too slow, and not just by a little bit, I think by quite a bit. So we really need to find some pace because everyone has traffic. You have to look a little bit more to optimum lap time, so optimum sectors, and we are quite off. It also didn't feel great to drive. Normally, I'm quite comfortable in the car. I can easily get it to a pace, but it takes too long, and it's not how I like it. So far, it's been the most difficult weekend," end quote. So, I mean, that doesn't really lend a lot of sort of positive vibes going into this race if you're a fan of Red Bull and Max Verstappen, because you would think, well, maybe not that you would think, but I think I'm talking all over the place, you know. I'm thinking that after this race that we'll have had a pretty good selection of different kinds of tracks, and, you know, being five races into the season now, I think we should probably have a good idea of where all these cars are at and what tracks they're kind of suited to. I mean, like we were saying earlier, Monaco really is the big unknown, because there's going to be a safety car, there's going to be traffic, and everybody's going to get stuck behind somebody at some other point. I mean, a couple of years ago, remember, all the drivers were complaining how boring it was. It was basically one procession around because nobody could get close enough to pass. Everybody's getting stuck behind traffic. And it sometimes cannot be the most exciting race on the calendar. Sometimes you need something exciting to change it up and have a bit of a humorous moment, like the time Danny Ricciardo went into the pits for tires and Red Bull had no tires for him. Well, it was something like that, but that was obviously just a bit of an outlier. But you know what I mean, right? I mean, this race can be a little bit predictable, and it's also unique too, because it's very tight, it's very compact, like you'd mentioned. There's not a lot of straightaways, so I mean, this track is really in a class of its own, and it really... I really don't know where it would kind of factor into the grading sheet, if you wanted to call it, over the first five races and say, okay, well, the Red Bull was good here, here, and here. Mercedes was stronger there, there, and there. But, you know, over the first five races, maybe the Mercedes is the better all-round car compared to the Red Bull. So I don't know. Monaco's always such a weird one to kind of judge for me. It's such a unique and such a strange circuit.
You're right. And the other thing that's kind of interesting about the way that the calendar breaks out here is we were on a traditional purpose-built track in Bahrain, in Italy, in Portugal. The Spanish Grand Prix was the same. And then we have these back-to-back races on these really tight, windy street circuits. And again, I guess Baku isn't necessarily super windy, but there's definitely some tight corners, but it does have that one exceptionally long straightaway. Monaco
Baku is such like, it's such a strange circuit as well, because it's not really like a road circuit like any others. I mean, like you say correctly, there's some very tight, very technical, very windy corners, but there's also some very fast sections on that track as well. It's very different for different reasons than Monaco is. It's kind of the opposite to Monaco when it comes to a street circuit.
Yeah, and it's funny because as I was saying that they're different. I would say Monaco and Azerbaijan, Baku, they're different than a traditional purpose-built circuit, but they're not alike. And it's funny because I didn't really make that association in my head until I start looking at the tracks. Monaco is a race of its own. And I don't know if we want to get into kind of doing a preview now or kind of save that for the back half of the show, but Monaco is very, very, very special. And it's special for all the reasons that you just spoke to. And really, it's one of the things that makes Formula One special as a championship, because if you look at North American racing, if you look at the IndyCar series, you know, it's a combination of a couple of street circuits that are kind of roughly shoddily thrown together. You've got a couple of dedicated race circuits. You've got a mix of oval. NASCAR is predominantly oval, although they throw in some street races as well. Formula One's almost everything except oval, but you would never see a race like this in any of the other series. In fact, if Monaco was to approach Formula One today and they'd never hosted a race before, there's no way this race happens. This race happens because of history and because of tradition. And we will speak to a little bit of that later on.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, why don't we just take a little bit of a quick or an early break here, Mark, and come back. I want to get into the driver's silly season, because there's actually quite a lot to talk about. And then we can, after that, we can go and talk about the race itself. So let's take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to talk about the silly season. And for those of you who don't know what that is, we're going to speculate on who's going to go where for next season. That's always really fun. So we'll do that in just a moment. So don't go away. We'll be right back.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart, the seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
Okay, well, welcome back to the show. So yes, driver market time. It seems that silly season seems to start earlier and earlier every year. You know, it used to be sort of a middle of the summer kind of thing, but it seems it gets pushed back each and every year. So first of all, Valtteri Bottas believes that the upcoming summer break in the middle of, at the beginning of August would be what he says a good deadline to get a decision on his future with Mercedes and stop it from becoming a distraction later on in the season. And this, I think, you know, if you're Valtteri, I think you want to know in advance what their deal is going to be, if there's going to be a deal between the two of them, because ever since he joined that team early in 2017, it has just been one year rolling contract year after year after year. And I think that this year, maybe there's some more questions, which we've talked about, quite a bit. I don't think we really need to jump into like all the pros and cons of, keeping Valtteri Bottas in that team. And, you know, I mean, he's done the job that they've needed him to do. He's helped them win multiple championships. He's won a bunch of races himself. So he's had success there. But he said that, that from his point of view, that getting an answer on what his contract situation decided and sort of earlier is always going to be a lot better for him. And he said that he hasn't really thought too much about it just yet. And he said at this point in time, he's just concentrating on the racing, but he wants to know earlier or as early as possible about what his future is going to be with Mercedes. And then obviously within Formula One, you know, it really is kind of funny because when you hear comments like that, especially so early into a season, I mean, we're roughly a quarter of the way into the season so far, not quite. And to hear drivers sort of talking about what their future might be, it just, I'm still trying to figure out who's at which team right now. And it seemed like, you know, it seemed like the driver market was fairly settled. But I mean, there are just in the background, and we talk about it from time to time on the show, that there are some big question marks going out there. So, you know, potentially, I mean, any move at Mercedes could really kick off like a big snowball effect in the driver market and people moving around, because that would obviously be the one seat everybody would want to get.
For a little bit of context, I think it's important to remember, and you teed this up perfectly, but I think it's important to remember that Valtteri joined Mercedes after the shock retirement of Nico Rosberg. So he wins the title in 2016. It came down to the wire, probably the most exciting championship of the last 7 or 8 years. And then he shocks the Formula One world by retiring. And Valtteri Bottas gets the deal with Mercedes, but you teed it up perfectly. Every single year, it's been a one-year deal. Now, And you know what, the timing for this is actually perfect, because we actually got a question on Twitter from @LSpaceMonkey. Seeing as Lando signed a new contract, how do contracts work in F1, from pay scale to how many years they sign? One of the things that I think we should probably stress here is that Formula One drivers get very, very, very little security. I think in North American sports, we're used to seeing athletes sign these 3, 4, 5, 7. In the NHL and Major League Baseball, we see these 7, 10, 13-year deals. Mm-hmm. And in a lot of sports, it's guaranteed money. In Formula One, they are super short-term deals. And if you look at Valtteri Bottas, and you nailed it, every single contract he signed with Mercedes has been a one-year deal. So he races every single season without any understanding of where he's going to be racing the next year or whether he's even going to be in Formula One. So I thought this was an interesting comment for him to make, in part because, unfortunately, he has zero leverage in that negotiation. Mm-hmm. He has zero leverage. Like, we're 4 races into the championship. He had a DNF, a couple of podiums. He hasn't really been that racy in terms of the car. He hasn't won a race. Ultimately, I think the only thing he could do to influence this negotiation is to want to win a bunch of races, but I don't even think that's enough. I think deep down, Mercedes has made their decision, and it might be to stay with them. It might be to go with George Russell, but he's never had that security before, and he can talk about hoping to have security, but I think for him, it's probably just as much the peace of mind, and I think if he's not going to come back, I think he would like to know that mid-season, because you made that comment earlier about the fact that it could potentially just become a distraction, and we talked about that with Hamilton for the past 6 months, that, you know, this year is going to be a distraction, and it probably will, but I think for Bottas, it's just about the peace of mind. Look, yeah, if you're not bringing me back, I need to know. I want to be able to start planning my future, having conversations with other teams. Yeah. And if you do want to bring me back, let's get something done mid-season. But I think if I'm Mercedes, if I know I'm not going to bring him back, sure, I'm going to share that. But if I'm on the fence, I need to see the full season. I need to see the full book of work to be able to make that decision, because I'm not going to commit to you mid-season when there's 12 races left on the calendar and you may fall apart and we get criticized. So he may want it, but he has zero leverage in this discussion.
Yeah, which I think is pretty unfortunate. I mean, I think he's done a great job for Mercedes. I mean, he's done everything and more than what they've asked of him. I mean, he's been the ideal teammate to Lewis. I mean, any of that toxicity that existed in that team in the Hamilton-Rosberg era disappeared the day that Nico retired. You know, what was it? It was like a week after he won the championship, maybe not even. That was the most bizarre thing. I mean, he came in and did everything and more that they needed him to do. But correct me if I'm wrong, but did he not have, at least in the past, were some of his deals not like a one-year contract with a team option or something like that? And this year was just like a straight-out one-year deal with no option at the end of it? Or yeah, am I thinking of somebody else?
There were one plus ones. This was the first year where it was simply a
one-off. A one-off, yeah, okay. Now. Yeah, thank you, yeah. So yeah, I mean, totally. I mean, so he wants to know as soon as possible, because I think that was, if you go back to last year, if you look at the two Haas drivers, Roman Grosjean and Kevin Magnussen, I think they were told, wasn't it in and around the, what was it, the Eiffel Grand Prix at the Nürburgring? It was late in the season when they found out that they weren't going to be coming back. And I think the comments that came from both of them was, yeah, well, you know, that sucks. And, you know, well, we're not going to be here, but, you know, that's racing, but why couldn't you told us earlier, because then it would have given us more time to look at options for the future. I mean, ultimately, they both went on to do other things, but you could understand why somebody would be a little bit upset about that. I mean, Bottas. I mean, we've talked about, you know, what, you know, a Mercedes team with him in it at that age would be, and the prospects and stuff like that. But I think that Valtteri is still a very, very good Formula One driver. And I think that there would be a lot of teams interested in his services. But when you look around the grid, that the teams that have drivers under contract and who's going to be where for next year, kind of makes you wonder that if Mercedes don't bring him back, that, you know, where would he land? And maybe that's part of the reasoning that Valtteri is having himself, saying that the more notice I can get, the better, because if it's not going to be here, maybe he's kind of thinking something similar. Well, maybe I might not have a seat in Formula One next year. Maybe I'm going to have to sit out a year, or maybe this is, you know, if I'm not going to get a seat with a Mercedes, it's maybe not going to be with a team that's going to be, well, maybe not their equal, but another, say, top-tier team. You know, am I looking at like a Haas or an Alfa Romeo, or, you know, a team like that? And I think if you're Valtteri Bottas, you'd probably be like, well, thanks, but no thanks. Maybe I'll go and look at, you know, maybe I'll, you know, race in endurance cars. Maybe I'll try my hand at Le Mans or something like that, right? So I think he's maybe looking in that direction. That's just kind of the vibe that I want, or I'm getting from him, right?
That's a great point. And I think you're right that for him, part of it's peace of mind, but part of it's because if he's not going to come back, he needs to find another job next year. And it might be in Formula One. Like, who knows? Maybe there's a driver swap with Williams and he basically just changes seats with George Russell. You know, he's familiar with the Grove team. He spent a lot of time there. He raced for that team. He's scored podiums for that team. Maybe that's a natural transition. But that team may also itself be looking for pay drivers that bring sponsorships, because that's not something that Valtteri Bottas has the capacity to do today. But ultimately, to your point, if he's not going to be in Formula One next year, he needs as much time as possible to find a seat in a different series, because again, he's young enough that he's probably still looking to race, and he would need time to find a contract and a sponsor and a team to take him on an Indy car. He's certainly not going to go to stock racing, but endurance racing or any of these other touring car series in North or in Europe. But the other challenge too is, by F1 standards, he's relatively well paid. And again, that going back to that question from our listener on Twitter, F1 contracts are very, 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 very secretive. They're not published publicly. In fact, Formula One contracts are contained in a quote-unquote secret archive at the FIA's Contract Recognition Board in Geneva, which is in fact only accessible to 6 lawyers appointed to hear contractual disputes as they may arise between the teams, the body, and the FIA. So the contracts are signed and they're stowed away. Now, a lot of information comes out, and typically teams will make public the terms, so the term of the contract, but the actual financial components and the incentives, because it's generally understood that most contracts have kind of a base salary, and then drivers can build on that with performance bonuses. So, hey, if you get a pole, we're going to bonus you $150,000. Or if you accumulate 50 points, we're going to give you $100,000 for every point. So there's different kind of incentives like that. But in terms of what it's understood to look like this year, Lewis Hamilton sits at the top, and it's understood that he's probably going to earn about $30 million from his Mercedes deal. That's actually down significantly from last year, which is probably one of the reasons why he was so sour coming out of those contract negotiations with Mercedes. Max Verstappen is second at 25 million. Fernando Alonso is at 20. Ricciardo's at 15. Vettel's at 15. Leclerc's at 12. Valtteri Bottas is at $10 million. And if you look at the bottom, you've got drivers like Yuki making about 500 to 800K. It's speculated. Russell's a million. Latifi's a million. Mazepan's a million. And Mick Schumacher's a million. And again, in some of those cases, they're pay drivers. So that's a token number that they basically have to publish to show that the driver's earning something. But yeah, Formula One contracts are pretty interesting. And the other thing I just wanted to add, just while we're on the topic of contracts, because I always find this interesting, and I think our North American listeners will as well. In North America, we're used to sports where players sign a contract, and if they so much as look at another team before that contract is over, there's tampering charges, there's fines, there's investigations. In Formula One, there's no collective bargaining agreement. So you sign a contract, but you are more than welcome to go start shopping for a new contract before the conclusion of that deal. And we saw that last year with Carlos Sainz, which, you know, he had a contract with Ferrari before he'd even started his final season with McLaren. So you see some really unique things in Formula One that you wouldn't see in North American sports. But that's all I got on contracts.
Well, it was funny too when you were talking about that. I was thinking about some of the, well, I wouldn't say some of the weirder things, but maybe some of the more lucrative terms. Wasn't it Kimi Räikkönen? Was it way back in 2012 or something, 2013, when he was with Lotus? Didn't he get like what was his deal for the bonuses? Was it something like 50,000 euros per point that he scored in the World Championship or something like that? They never figured he was going to score as many points as he did, and he had like this ridiculous multi-million euro bonus that needed to be paid out at the end of the year, which I think basically really hit Lotus really hard on the bottom end to pay out all this cash. And they never thought that he'd have a chance to earn all these bonus points.
From Reddit, because this is one of the most amazing facts in F1 history. Kimi Räikkönen, I'm so glad you brought this up, by the way. Kimi Räikkönen's Lotus contract for 2012-2013 included a 50,000 euro bonus for every constructor's point he scored. Okay. Now, obviously, the team wasn't expecting to score a lot of points. He scored 390 points, earning an extra 19.5 million euro. Lotus almost went bankrupt. They literally almost went, and they're no longer in the sport. They literally almost went bankrupt paying out that amount plus his base salary.
That's it's absolutely crazy. I knew it was something like that. I couldn't remember what the grand total was in the end, but that's absolutely mind-blowing. And then, well, I mean, if you look at it, I mean, Lotus eventually became Renault, which is now Alpine, right? But it makes you wonder, because when did they pull out then? Was it the end of 2014? And then Lotus became, well, I guess Renault was just basically a rebadged Lotus for 2015, but it kind of makes you wonder that huge 19.5 million euro bonus that they had to pay Kimi back at the end of 2012, 2013, or whenever it was. That must have really hurt them, put them in a tough spot. And whoever negotiated that deal on the Lotus side would probably got to, you know, must have had a pretty stern talking to, let's put it that way, from his bosses after that was done. It's just like, you thought this was a good idea. Why?
Yeah, totally. and who's at fault there? Is it that the team negotiating that deal has just such unclear expectations of what the team can do? Or did the team overperform and such? Like, that would be a really interesting 30 for 30. And just to,
yeah, totally.
For those of you that are going to now go and kind of Google Lotus F1, there was a period in recent F1 history when there were, in essence, two different Lotus F1 teams racing at the same time due to some very weird and peculiar licensing agreements. So if you go down that Wikipedia rabbit hole, don't be too surprised if you run into that oddity as well.
It's just like the Canadian Football League, where you have an 8 or 9 team league wherein two of the teams are called the Rough Riders. So there you go. It's a multi-sport phenomena. Hey, anyways, sticking with the driver's market, this next story kind of leads into where I eventually want to go with this. So we'll start it now. We'll have a break coming up, then we'll pick it up on the other side. But Lando Norris, 21 years old, has just signed what's called a multi-year deal with McLaren. So the terms of the deal, being wonderfully vague in Formula One terms, says that he's going to be with the team until 2022 and beyond. So, okay, well, whatever. So he's going to be there at least for this year and next year. And Danny Ricciardo is going to be there until at least the end of 2023. So that driver pairing is set for at least the next couple of years. So I think this is great. I think that Lando 100% to deserve the opportunity that he got with McLaren, he's paid them back over the first couple of years that he's been in Formula One. I think that we've still are yet to see the best of Lando Norris. I'm excited to see where he's going to go, and I think he's absolutely deserving of this extension. And I would love to get my hands in that secret vault in Geneva to see the exact terms of this contract. But no doubt, he's been richly rewarded for what he's done, and I think it's great to see. I think that he's one of the. I think it's kind of cool too. Just a lot of these young guys that we're talking about getting deals like this. Charles is one. Charles Leclerc, Carlos Sainz getting a good deal with Ferrari, and Lando Norris, and a lot of these young drivers that maybe we didn't expect to maybe we did expect, where we had hopes that they would stick with these teams. I think we're starting to see it now. And of course, Max Verstappen, he signed that long-term deal with Red Bull, I guess it was beginning of 2020 or late 2019. So it's kind of cool to see these young drivers delivering on the track and then being rewarded for it. So good for Lando.
I agree. I wish I knew what multi-year translated into. I think it's probably 2 years beyond whatever he's under contract for now. I think that's a pretty rich deal. We do see the occasional three-year deal. Charles Leclerc signed one a couple of years ago. Sergio signed one with Lawrence Stroll, although we all know how that one turned out, basically getting ripped up halfway through. But I also want to credit McLaren because they did a really snazzy job of promoting this signing on social media. They did this really cool video, and it's a video that shot from kind of the first person perspective of Lando, and he's kind of sitting in the hospitality suite and somebody approaches him like, hey, Zach wants to speak to you. He's like, okay. And he's walking, you're just seeing it from his perspective, and he keeps running into members of the McLaren team like, oh, Zach wants to speak to you. Zach wants to speak to you. And eventually he gets down to the office and opens the door, and Zach's there. He's got the contract sitting on the table in front of him. So I thought it was kind of cool how they integrated the entire team into this video and this contract announcement. But yeah, excited for him. And I think both you and I think very, very highly of him, both as a person and as a driver. And he's also wonderful from a social media perspective because he's got a great Twitch presence. He's got a really, really great, loyal, young following. And he's just a charismatic individual. So great signing for McLaren. I would say, though, that he probably didn't also have a lot of leverage in this negotiation. Mm-hmm. You know, he's done pretty well, and he's scored some podiums, although there have been circumstances that enabled that to happen. But ultimately, if he goes to negotiate with McLaren, you take whatever they offer you, because what's the alternative? Where else are you going to go? Like, this is such a great seat. You probably don't have a lot of leverage. So I think in his case, I'll take whatever I can get, and then I'll earn incremental income through lucrative sponsorships in the UK. Because, of course, he's a British driver, mm-hmm. a team based out of the UK. From a promotional perspective, the sky's the limit.
Yeah, absolutely. And the one thing that, me reading between the lines here, when I saw 2022 and beyond, I thought 2 year deal with an option. So I'm thinking maybe, two, possibly 3 years. And that would seem to be about the norm. Now, talking about one of his, I guess you could say classmates, because Esteban Ocon, he kind of fits into that generation of drivers like Charles Leclerc, Lando Norris, George Russell, etc. Anyways, so apparently Alpine are already in talks with Esteban about a new contract to keep him there next year. No details really being released on that, other than that they're talking. And I think we talked about it a couple of weeks ago that maybe he's one of the more underrated drivers on the grid this season. And it really is kind of fascinating to see how he's matching up against his teammate, 300-year-old Fernando Alonso, two-time world champion. But Fernando kind of still finding his feet. He's had some moments over the first four races, but I think if this is exciting for Esteban, I mean, he signed a 2-year deal with Renault in 2020. After he sat out that 1 year in 2019, and last year, it was disappointing in a sense, but I think what we saw was I guess you could call it a hangover of a guy that was forced to sit out a year and miss a year, because when the musical chairs of the Formula One drivers market stopped in 2019 or after 2018, whenever it was, he ended up without a seat, and it took a long time for him to shake off the rust. But I think he's rebounded nicely. I think that we started to see a bit of resurgence, a bit of a rebirth towards the end of last year. And this year, I think he's more back to, he reminds me more of the Esteban Ocon a couple of years ago prior to that 1 year enforced layoff. So if he manages to land, a new deal with Alpine, I think that's great if you're Esteban Ocon for sure.
And we talked about this a couple of weeks ago, but I really can't speak highly enough about his first full season of Formula One. Like, he started racing in the back half of 2016 with Manor. That was never a team that was going to be particularly competitive. And of course, they exited the sport after the end of the season. But his first full season with Force India, like, you look at his performances, he finished in the points in all but two races, except for Montreal, where he finished 12th, and Brazil, where he retired. That's an unbelievable start, because it just shows consistency. Mm-hmm. And Formula One cars are incredibly difficult to drive, especially when you're young and especially when you're getting used to the aerodynamics and the grip and the tires. So to put in that level of consistency in the first season is absolutely remarkable. And to your point, it was a little bit heartbreaking that, and I love that term, musical chairs, that when the music stopped playing, he just didn't have a seat, right? But ultimately, I think it's a great move by Alpine. And I think the other thing that's really smart for Alpine about this is, if they want to build this brand that's kind of connected to French identity because it's a French team and they wear French colors and all those other kind of pieces. It's really helpful to have a talented French driver mm-hmm. in your race seat. And we'll talk a little bit more about that when we get to MotoGP Corner in about an hour, hour and a half. But I think it's a smart move for this team. And so far, it seems like his relationship with Fernando's very good. I shouldn't say very good. It's good because historically, the relationships that Fernando has had with most of his teammates haven't been great, especially when the driver in the other seat is equally as competitive. So it's been a good dynamic so far, and I'm happy for him, and I think this is the right move for Alpine.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, well, let's take another break here, Mark, and then when we come back, I kind of want to bring it full circle, but not quite. We started with Valtteri Bottas. I want to talk next about George Russell because he's had a couple of things to say about his own contract situation. And of course, when you talk about Valtteri, you automatically start thinking about George Russell. So we'll do that on the other side of the break. So don't go away. We'll be right back. All right, well, welcome back to the show, and we're going to round up our discussion on, the opening round here of the 2021 driver market silly season. Anyways, George Russell says that he wants his next contract in Formula One to be a multi-year deal so he can achieve what he calls have consistency in order to grow and progress. So his contract with Williams expires at the end of this year, and let's put it this way. I think that George has done pretty good since he managed to get into Formula One with Williams. Obviously, it was never going to be a team that he was going to achieve podiums or race wins with, but I think that he's done very well since he's been there. I mean, it was going to be difficult because it was a team that was obviously struggling. We're starting to see maybe some promising hints now that they've got new ownership in place. But still, I mean, when he filled in for Lewis Hamilton and Sakhir last year in that one-off race, I mean, he was very, very impressive. And I think that for George, when you go around and you see these stories about Lando, you see these stories about Esteban Ocon, you see stories about like Carlos Sainz signing a contract with Ferrari or Max Verstappen signing a multi-year deal with Red Bull and Charles Leclerc, all these guys that, he has a history with or has raced against a lot of these guys in Formula 2 and other formulas. He's kind of like the one guy he's almost being a little bit left out of the conversation. I mean, ultimately, who knows? Maybe he gets that second seat at Mercedes, maybe goes on to have a great career with them. Maybe it's a Cinderella story waiting to happen. We don't know. That's going to play out in front of us at some point, but totally you can see just maybe a bit of the frustration and I don't want to say the futile nature of the situation, but you can see frustration in that sort of, I'd say, very politically worded statement to have consistency in order to grow and progress. I think that he's kind of realizing that if he stays where he is, that maybe he's going to hit the ceiling, and just in terms of his own career, that he wants more, and I think that he's earned it.
Imagine. So let's back the truck up a little bit. Let's go back to 2018. So George Russell in 2018 wins the Formula 2 championship, which is the open wheel championship immediately before low Formula 1. It's the principal feeder series. He wins the championship by like 80 points over Lando Norris. In third place was Alexander Albon. In the meantime, this poor guy has now spent 3 years in Formula One. So again, I'm sure he's very thankful to be in Formula One, but he's now spent 3 years with what has been consistently the worst team in the championship in that time, while watching other young drivers that are basically part of his class, like Alexander Albon, get a shot with Red Bull, watching Lando Norris score podiums, watching Charles Leclerc score podiums and race wins, watching other young drivers like Carlos Sainz and Esteban Ocon and Pierre Gasly win races, and Yuki Tsunoda scored a point in his first race in Formula One, and it took Russell almost two full seasons and a fluke ride with Mercedes to score points. Like, from his perspective, I think he has every right to be brimming with frustration at this point. Like, where is my shot? Like, all these drivers that I've beaten in every single lower tier of open wheel racing, they are getting rides and fighting for points and fighting for podiums, and I never have that opportunity. And I think we can probably trust at this point that he's doing everything possible with this car. And I think for his sake, and I think for the betterment of Formula One, he needs to be in a better whip. And ultimately, I think you're right. He's going to look for a long-term deal. I think the question is ultimately where it's going to be. So he's managed by Toto. He's a Mercedes driver. He was sponsored by Mercedes coming up through the lower formulas. I think the natural progression for him would be Mercedes, but if Mercedes opts to go in a different direction for 2022, I don't think he's going to be back with Williams, because I think his contractual obligations had him there for 3 years. I think the question where is he going to land? Because to your earlier point, we're starting to see some of these other doors close, which if Ocon re-ups with Alpine, it's not going to be Alpine, and Nando's re-upped with McLaren, it's not going to be McLaren. Where's that opportunity going to be for him? It's going to be interesting, and it's definitely going to be a distraction if this doesn't get cleared up in the next few months.
Yeah, you know, I can't help but feel a bit sorry for the guy, because, I mean, he's worked really, really, really hard, and he's done everything he possibly can at Williams. And, I mean, I know that he has that, that nickname of Mr. Saturday, which is, it's not really supposed to be anything kind of like snide or underhanded, but I mean, the thing is, I think he does more than that car is really capable of. And just to say, okay, well, getting into Q2, big whoop, you know, that's no big deal. But, you know, if you're in a Williams, that actually is a bit of a big deal, because they really don't have too much of a hope of scoring points under most normal race circumstances, right? I mean, if things get flipped on their heads, if there's safety cars and there's bad weather and some misfortune for other drivers, then yeah, sure, maybe they'll sneak into the points, or maybe this weekend is one race that they're looking at to win, because okay, you don't need that top end speed. Maybe that car's handles a little bit better than, you know, maybe it's a little bit deficient on the high, you know, the top end speed and stuff like that. So, but the thing is, I mean, let's just put it this way. I mean, they almost need a bit of a freak circumstance or a bit of a freak opportunity to score points. And, you know, if you're I was going to say Lando Norris or Charles Leclerc, all these guys, I mean, if George is listening to this, and he probably isn't, of course, but, you know, he must be frustrated, because that just goes to prove the point is that, you know, when you think of these young generation of drivers, you're thinking Lando, you're thinking Charles, you're thinking Esteban. And George is completely getting forgotten about in this conversation, and that must be so maddening for him. And as much as Valtteri Bottas wants an answer ASAP on what his status with Mercedes is either yes, you're coming back, or no, you're not, George is probably thinking the same thing for all those reasons that you mentioned, that, you know, he's out of contract at the end of the year at Williams. He's managed by Toto Wolff. He's a Mercedes driver and all these other things. And, you know, I know it was only one race, but he did so well. I mean, it was unfortunate that he ended up in, the final race classification where he did, because by rights, he should have won that race. And it was absolutely, it was one of those standout moments from last year, just how well he actually did right from the very first practice session through qualifying into the race itself. I mean, let's not forget, I mean, he barged his way past Valtteri Bottas right at the very start of the race. And if it wasn't for some of these unfortunate incidents later in the race, and, you know, that botched pit stop and everything like that, that put him back to what, eighth, ninth? Where did he end up in the end? Something like that. One of the lower point. Yeah, ninth. So just in the points, and I mean, basically to round it all out, I feel for the guy, because he clearly has demonstrated that he's got some talent, but, you know, now the question is, okay, we know he's got talent, but is he going to get the opportunity to demonstrate that challenge or that talent on a bigger stage? We don't know.
It's interesting as well, because as we talk through this, and I don't think we needed to have this conversation to draw this conclusion, but the future of George Russell is intrinsically linked to the future of Valtteri Bottas, right?
Like, yep.
If Bottas re-ups with Mercedes, that door closes for George Russell, which I think is the most desirable potential destination for him. But I think the challenge is all these other opportunities are closing before our eyes, and maybe ultimately a driver swap. And I never thought about this before, and I don't even know how receptive Valtteri Bottas would be to this, especially because Williams isn't in a position where they could potentially pay him what he would want. But maybe ultimately a driver swap, and we've seen this before, would be a natural move here, which is ultimately, you know what, Valtteri, you're going to keep a seat in Formula One. It's a team that you're familiar with. They're continuing to develop. You can help them. Your expertise would be good. He would be a valuable marketing asset for the Williams team as well, to have a driver that has that Mercedes association and this one Grand Prix. Like, yep. He could be useful to Williams in a lot of ways, but maybe ultimately the best thing here is a driver swap between the two teams. I think ultimately, like I said, their careers are intrinsically intertwined at this point, which is pretty interesting.
It is, and I can't help but looking at George Russell in 2021, and I can't help but seeing the reflection of Esteban Ocon in 2019 kind of like popping up, because the more that, every day and every week that this kind of drags on, I kind of get that sort of sinking feeling for George that, you know, if something doesn't happen, that, who knows, maybe he ends up in that same position. Maybe he ends up in a reserve driver role for Mercedes next year or for somebody else, and then maybe if it doesn't work out, then he's in the same, the same position that Esteban was a couple of years ago, that in order to progress in his own career, you know, he has to sever that link, those ties to Mercedes, which were so beneficial and so desirable to have as a younger driver. And, you know, this promise or this hope, this golden light that I'm part of the Mercedes organization. If I just do what I do and work hard and race as hard as I can, that I will filter into that team. And I'm sure that Esteban had that same, you know, hope and desire at some point in the past. And ultimately that didn't work out, and he had to cut those strings and move on. And we'll see how his career progresses from here. But I mean, initially at Alpine and Renault, it's been okay. And who knows, maybe that's where George is going to end up. Because I mean, we've seen other drivers that have had those ties. I mean, like a Pascal Wehrlein, he was reserve driver in the Hamilton-Rosberg era. He was, you know, potentially that guy, and it never worked out. And I mean, he's not with Mercedes, not even in Formula One anymore. So there you go.
I'll share this as well, because I think this would be interesting perspective for our listeners. In 2013, Valtteri Bottas raced for Williams. It was a really difficult year for that team. That was the final year of the V8 era. In 2014, which was the first year of the V6 turbo hybrid era, he finished fourth in the Drivers' Championship, fourth with six podiums. He finished third in Austria, second in the UK, second in Germany, third in Belgium, third in Russia, and third at the conclusion in Abu Dhabi. So he's done some very, very good things with that team in the past.
Oh, yeah,
so
absolutely.
Obviously, he has a favorable legacy with that team. I think that could be smart, but we'll see how it ultimately plays out. But I would be no more surprised if he left the sport than I would be if he stayed with Mercedes. So we'll see.
Yeah, it really is a situation that we're going to have to keep an eye on, over the weeks and months ahead. It's fun to speculate and talk about, for sure. Anyways, let's take a final break here, Mark. When we come back, well, let's preview the race ahead itself. I know that MotoGP Corner is coming up. I know you got lots of things you want to talk about and touch on there. So we'll do so in just a moment. So don't go away, guys. We'll be back in just one moment. All right, well, welcome back to the show, and well, let's get right into it, Mark. We have the Monaco Grand Prix that is already ongoing. It's already started. So let's just talk about some of the stats, some of the history behind Monaco. So just a little bit of info about the track itself. 78-lap race, or total race distance is a little bit over 260 kilometers. Circuit length is 3.3 kilometers long. The lap record was set by Max Verstappen in 2018 at a 114.260. This is interesting too. I mean, this is a very grippy, very abrasive track, and you know, it's interesting because, or at least that's my take was. That's what I thought it would be, and it actually turns out to be quite the opposite to that, because Pirelli is actually bringing the softest tires in their range, the C5, the C4, and the C3, which are the softest, grippiest tires. So I just thought that being Monaco the way that it is, I thought it was a super rough, abrasive circuit or a track surface. And it's not. So that's what we're going to see for the you know, for the tires this weekend. But you know, it is interesting too. I mean, if you go back and you look at the history of this this race, I mean, it was started. The first race was way back in 1929 or something. I mean, it's literally been around forever. You know, it actually predates the Formula One World Championship in its modern guise. So the driver that is the winningest driver at Monaco is Ayrton Senna. He won there six times between 1987 and 1993. Graham Hill and Michael Schumacher both won there five times. Alain Prost won there three times. Lewis Hamilton, in some pretty impressive company, he won there three times, as did Stirling Moss and Jackie Stewart. And his former teammate, Nico Rosberg, won there three times as well in 2013, 14, and 15. And then there's a whole whack of drivers that won there twice, including Fangio, including Lauda, Jody Scheckter, Fernando Alonso won there twice. Mark Webber won there twice, as did Sebastian Vettel. And then when it comes to the constructors, do you know who the most winningest team at Monaco is?
I do.
You do?
And it's McLaren.
Oh, I'm disappointed. I was hoping I'd stumped you, but apparently you're a walking encyclopedia, but you're correct. Yeah, the winningest constructor is indeed McLaren. They've won there 15 times, but the most recent win for McLaren was way back in 2008. Ferrari's won there 10 times, Mercedes 8 times. And the last time we had this race, because of course it wasn't run last year because of the pandemic, 2019, Lewis Hamilton won this this Grand Prix. So, you know, what do we talk about specifically when it comes to this race? You know, I think basically the one thing you can say that is predictable about Monaco is how unpredictable it is, because, you know, anything literally can happen here. I mean, you can get some very, very weird race results here. I mean, you go back to the mid-90s and Olivier Panis winning his one and only Grand Prix in Formula One for Ligier, of all teams. That's probably the only race that they ever won. maybe they won more, but I don't ever recall that. But it is really, like we said earlier in the show, it is a race that is unique in and of itself, and it is like you said earlier as well, it's special in its own right for a bunch of different reasons. So please go ahead and elaborate on that, please.
You know, I appreciate the perfect segue. You've really teed this up and inadvertently stolen a lot of my thunder, but I think
we'll go
good.
Back and we'll re-record we'll this
rewind.
Segment there.
Yeah, we'll clean this up in post. You were far too on the point tonight, so we'll reverse this. But yeah, it's important for a couple of reasons, and I think you hit on one of them, which is one, in terms of tradition and history, this race has been on the calendar, to your point, even before there was a Formula One championship. It's been part of the history of the sport since the inception of the sport. It's been around since 1929, and there are other races that have been around for a long time as well, including Silverstone and including Monza. But one of the things that makes Monza so special, or Monaco so special, is that the track layout itself that we're going to race on Sunday is almost identical to the layout that was used, the configuration that was used back in 1929. So the consistency just rolls over and over and over. So that's good for legacy and tradition and history. The challenge, though, is that layout, that configuration was built for cars that were roughly a quarter of the size of today's cars. Today's cars are big. I mean, the Formula One cars of today are big compared to the cars of 2016. And that makes racing a little bit more challenging, but we'll get to that in a minute. So there's really three things that make Monaco important. First is tradition and history. The other is ambience and atmosphere. And we're not going to see it this weekend. So if this is the first time you've watched Monaco, I apologize. You're not going to get the full Monaco experience. But almost all of the wealth and all of the celebrity in Europe and a lot of the celebrity from the US converges on Monaco for this weekend. And that's seen by people pouring out of the windows and the balconies of the hotels. It's people in yachts. In fact, I think there's another, I guess we see a really heavy yacht presence in Abu Dhabi now, but not as much as even Monaco's. So there's this really strong atmosphere, there's this presence, and it's one of the only races that takes place in the metro center of a city. So we see it in Melbourne, we see it in Montreal, we see it in Singapore, but it is right in the center of the city. The entire city basically gives up a weekend to accommodate the race, and it's part of the culture, and it's very much a part of the identity of the city. And then again, in terms of the views, you have the oceans, you have the mountains. It's a beautiful setting, and it's a picturesque backdrop for a race. And then the third thing is that for the drivers, You know, we look at it, it's a tight course, it's relatively short. It is an absurdly challenging course for the drivers for a couple of reasons. One is that there aren't any significant long straights, which means they don't get to leverage DRS. The downside as well to the fact that there aren't any long straights is it doesn't give the opportunity for, it doesn't give the drivers the opportunity to relax or rest. Like, we probably don't think about this because they're sitting in a car the whole time, they're just sitting there. Drivers depend on long straights to relax their neck muscles, to relax their backs, to relax their grip on the steering wheel. They need that momentary break to be able to regroup physically. And the challenge for Monaco is because there are no long straights, the drivers are tensed up and they're focused the entire race. And if you ever hear some of the drivers speak, this is one of the most exhausting races on the calendar. The other challenge is that because it's so tight, drivers make on average 50 gear changes per lap, and each lap is only 74 seconds. So they're making a gear change on average every 1.5 seconds. It's an absolute grind. And then, like you said, you make a mistake on this track, it is an unforgiving track and your weekend is over. In fact, the race could be suspended or a red flag. So it's a very challenging track. And then the other thing too is that from a car perspective, the strain on the gearbox, the strain on the brakes, it's very, very challenging. And because, again, there's no long straights, there's no opportunity to cool the brakes, there's no opportunity to cool the engine, the cars are stressed, the drivers are stressed, it's exhausting. And it may not look like it because they're not hitting some of these top speeds, but sometimes when these cars are at the top speeds on these long straights, that's the most relaxed the car is, that's the most relaxed the driver is. So for all those reasons, it's a very, very unique and very, very, very special track. Now, the criticism is that ultimately becomes a possession. And what we've seen historically is that overwhelmingly, the person who takes pole wins the race. And that's unfortunate, but it just makes qualifying that much more exciting because qualifying is that much more relevant. The other couple of points that I'll mention as well, and this is always kind of interesting just in the context of motorsports, is there's this unofficial motorsports triple crown, which is the Grand Prix of Monaco, which is the Indy 500, and 24 Hours of Le Mans. And there's drivers like Fernando Alonso that have pursued and tried to win this unofficial triple crown. So as the context of motorsports go globally, this is one of the most important events. And then finally, and this is really unique, for a principality that houses just 40,000 people, Monaco has produced 5 Formula One drivers. In fact, Charles Leclerc himself is from Monaco.
Yeah, there you go. You know, it is interesting too, but just when I was listening to you, just speak that last piece there, Mark, the one thing that really stood out to me is that Formula One nowadays, it's rare to see several cars retire in a race because of mechanical issues. And Monaco is usually that exception. I mean, attrition for one reason or another is usually an issue. It's either, like you say, somebody kisses a wall, breaks a piece of suspension, or has a big crash and destroys the car, or, you know, the brakes overheat or the engine overheats and, you know, something in the car breaks and their race is done. So, I mean, there's almost any of those any one of those things can happen to end somebody's race on Sunday. So I'm going to put it to you now before we segue into MotoGP Corner to wrap up the show. So who are you going to pick to win this race? Are you going to stick with the usual Max or Lewis narrative that we've been going with this year? Are you going to be a little bit more daring and come up with maybe a little bit more unexpected pick for a race winner?
It's interesting, and I'm actually going to defer to a listener that sent us a tweet. Do you mind if I read this tweet?
Yeah, go for it. So I've got my pick, but I'm interested to hear what other people have been saying.
So basically, I'm deferring because I'm not brave enough to make a pick, but I'm going to defer to this question. So this is from a listener, Ha Allo, or at H-Y-S-A-L-O. Hey guys, so McLaren's boldest backline has got me thinking about this weekend's GP. The phrase is extremely apt for Monaco, a track that requires as bold a driving style as any track on the calendar. While us mere mortals can only revel in what those 19 men do on the streets of Monaco, hashtag Mazepin, we can be bold in our own right, and that is in our predictions. And for whatever reason, I've had a few of my own this week, and I'd be thrilled to know yours. Here are mine. Firstly, I don't believe either Hamilton or the Statman, not a typo, I'm coining the nickname, will win. In fact, I think Perez finished ahead of his Red Bull teammate for the first time. I also believe Daniel Ricciardo will get his first McLaren podium and may even win. Finally, provided he can finish the race, I think Russell gets into the points. I'd be thrilled to know your bold, he's challenging us here, your bold predictions, and would be happy to provide rationale, however tinfoil hat that you might like it, on mine. Keep up the good work, guys. Hateman from the UK.
So that is an amazing, that is a really great message. Well, I am as stupid as I look, so I'm going to make a bold or stupid prediction here. I want to go a little bit different. I like the fact that he's going a little bit outside of the box, to use that phrase. But yeah, I want to go with somebody a little bit different than Max or Lewis. And that's why I think that qualifying is going to be really, really fascinating. Can somebody really stick a really hot lap around there and put it on the pole and really shock everyone and then manage to hang on those entire 78 laps? I was going to just to sort of like pick randomly a hat or a name out of the hat, but I'm kind of feeling Charles Leclerc has a shot at winning this race this weekend. I don't know why. It's just for me, it's a bit of a gut feeling. I think that he's obviously got unfinished business there. I mean, the only time that he's had a chance to really win that race in a competitive car was a couple of years ago, and his Ferrari didn't even make it out of the garage that day in his second year in Formula One, and it's been a couple of years, and he didn't get the opportunity last year. Ferrari, as we talked about off the top of the show, was looking pretty pacey in practice, legitimate or otherwise. So I don't know. I'm feeling Charles Leclerc might have a legit shot to win this race. How about you?
One of the things I love about that listener is he was basically inserting prop bets into this, which I think is kind of cool. So I'm going to go with my prop bets first. And I don't actually know if that's what, I don't know if I'm using that term properly, but here's a couple of things that I think will happen.
Okay.
I think 15 or fewer cars are going to finish the race. I think we'll see, to your point, a lot of attrition, especially with some of these younger drivers like Mazepin and Sonata and Mick Schumacher and Nicholas Latifi that have never seen this track before. I think there'll be a lot of early attrition.
Yep.
I think that Aston Martin is going to get a car into the points as a knock-on effect of the attrition. And I think a driver other than Lewis or Max will win the race. But I'm not bold enough to go any more precise than that.
Well, you know, the big key to the start of this race is from start finish, you have that very short run up the straight into that 90-degree right-hander at Saint-Devot. If the entire field can get through that corner clean, then it's going to be interesting. But as we've seen over the years, that we can see contact at that corner throughout the race and especially at the start. So those first couple, several laps are going to be really interesting to watch to see how the cars go through there. I mean, it is one of those sort of magnet points for drama. I mean, Max had a big shunt there a couple of years ago. I think that might have even been when he was with Toro Rosso, going back several years now. But certainly that's one point that you have to keep an eye out for. And certainly I think that what happens in those first couple of laps and depending whether we lose any cars right off of the bat will really determine, who's left and where they're sitting and ultimately how things play out and whether or not we see any overtaking or if it's going to be a repeat of a couple of years ago when all the drivers afterwards were complaining that it was a procession and it wasn't fun. But at the same time, it was kind of fun to watch at home because that was the race where Ricardo, what was he had some issue. I think it was his gearbox or something, wasn't it? Didn't he lose like first, second, and third gear or something like that?
Yep,
or,
and still finished.
He still finished. So, I mean, that was exciting to watch just whether or not he could hang on to it. So, there are sometimes it can be a little bit boring, can be a little bit processional, but it can also be an exciting race. And that's part of the fun of it as well. So
We have another question from a listener via Twitter, but you know what? I'm actually going to save this one. It's a great question from @FockaFire, but I think we'll save that for the next podcast because it's probably something we'd want to spend 5 or 10 minutes on. So I'm going to shelve that. But before we move on, we did post, so we actually put up a bit of a Scuderia F1 quiz on our Twitter feed a couple of days ago. So I had posted, and I want to make sure I give credit to the people that got this right, but we had posted a photo of a 2016 spec Ferrari on track in 2016. And we had asked very specifically, there is something very unique and very unusual about this car. And we got a ton of responses, but only two of them were right. So I shout out to DJ, or otherwise known at TheVice1999, and Rajesh Padalkar, because both of them, both Rajesh Padalkar and DJ at TheVice1999, identified that the 2016 spec Ferrari that was pictured on our Twitter feed was wearing a halo. And the halos weren't officially introduced until 2018. This was a bit of a quiz to see if anyone could spot the unique attribute of this car. But that photo was actually taken at Yas Marina while the team was doing a little bit of halo testing. So Formula One had done some testing during the 2016 season, mid-season 2017, and they finally introduced the halo for the 2018 season. So shout out to both of you for picking up the unusual oddity that was on that Ferrari car.
You know, it's funny. I mean, in retrospect now, looking back at sort of pre-Halo cars, I've become completely used to it compared to where we were several years ago. It's like, I don't know how I could ever get used to seeing a car with a Halo. Isn't it funny?
Dude, I feel uncomfortable when I see a car without a Halo now. I'm like, ooh, that doesn't feel safe. It's like when I see a young kid riding a bike without a helmet. Like, ooh, that's not good. Where are your parents?
Well, I mean, just ask Charles Leclerc when he had Fernando Alonso go over the front of his car at Spa a couple of years ago. How thankful was he to have the halo on his car that day. Hey, anyways, Mark, I would be totally remiss and I would be an awful friend if I didn't give you a chance to throw in MotoGP Corner. I mean, you're going to start dialing up the music here. So go ahead and do your thing. You know, I must admit that I wanted some like Italian music for you. I tried calling Pavarotti before this one and he didn't pick up. So, you know, whatever.
I appreciate the effort. And I just want to make clear that while you're spending hours and hours doing research and getting ready for the show, I'm spending 4 hours on the web looking for the perfect musical jingle. So it kind of shows where our priorities are. So I'll pause here so the music can start.
It's already going, my friends.
Oh, okay, never mind. Update this week, and I've kind of teased at this in the past. So quick update on the sport. We had the French Grand Prix last weekend. Super, super special. Jack Miller, an Australian rider for what's shaping up to be a phenomenal Ducati team this year, won the race. The very, very, very cool thing about it is that the sport currently has two French riders, and they both finished on the podium. Johann Zarco, also riding for Ducati, finished second, and Fabio Quartararo, I can never say his name, and I apologize to all of our French listeners, finished third, also finished on the podium for Yamaha. So a pretty special race for all those French fans to see both of the French riders in MotoGP finish on the podium. Now, what I wanted to speak to real quick was a little bit of context on one of the most important riders in MotoGP. There's a rider named Marc Marquez, not to be mistaken with another Marquez, because his brother is also now in the championship. He joined MotoGP in 2013. He then went on to win the championship that year. He won the championship in 2014. He won the championship in 16, 17, 18, and 19. So a bit of a Lewis Hamilton effect. He races for a team called Repsol Honda. That is Honda's official factory team. Honda both has a team and functions as an engine supplier. The difference, I think, between Marc Marquez and Lewis Hamilton, and I've kind of teased at this in the past a little bit, is that in MotoGP, the bike is important. The reliability is important. The power unit is important. All those things are important. But because the margin for error in MotoGP is so much slimmer, I just want to be clear that what he's been able to achieve over the first 6 or 7 years of his career is, I shouldn't say unprecedented because Valentino Rossi did it in the decades before, but is ultimately remarkable. The fact that he could put in so much consistency year over year over year is remarkable. So this is a guy now that has 6 championships. Again, like I said, actually, I'm mistaken. He has, 6 championships at the MotoGP level. He's only 28 years old. Now, he suffered a devastating injury last year, missed almost the entire championship, missed the first 2 races of this season, finished 7th in Portugal, 9th in Spain, and ultimately had a retirement due to an accident in France. But the eyes of the sport are on him because they want to see how quickly he can recover and things like that. So that's kind of the update this week. We're going into the next race in Italy, which should be an exciting one. It could potentially be maybe the last race that Valentino Rossi ever races in his home country, which it would be heartbreaking. Valentino Rossi has meant so much to the sport. When he goes back to Italy, it's a spectacle unlike anything that we see in Formula One. But that's our MotoGP corner update for this week. I'm done.
Whereabouts are they racing in Italy then?
Let's pause this because I should have known that. It is not Monza. Give me a second here. Italian GP, MotoGP 2021. This is super awkward. So hopefully you'll clean this up. Oh my God, it's Mugello. Of course it's Mugello. And this is one of the reasons why it was so cool to see Formula One go to Mugello last year. It's because it's a track I've seen for so long on the MotoGP track or on the MotoGP calendar. It was cool to see how Formula One translated. But yeah, we will be at Mugello this coming Sunday, May 30th.
You know, honestly, Mugello was one of those tracks that was kind of thrown in last year because of the rearranged schedule because of the pandemic. I was a little bit disappointed that it didn't make it onto the schedule this year. Obviously, it didn't work out, but certainly it was really cool to see. And I guess, you know, if you're done, I'm done. This is the perfect place to wrap it up. Monaco is going to be going in just over 48 hours, so we will be back on Sunday night. If you want to weigh in on what happens during the race or throughout the race weekend, please send us a tweet at @ScuderiaF1Pod or send us an email at ScuderiaF1Pod@gmail.com. And that's it. That's a wrap. On behalf of myself, Mark Daly, and my friend and co-host, Mark Hamilton, thanks for listening. Have a great weekend, and we'll talk to you again soon. Bye for now.